Search of Black Power. I am your host, Lawrence Grandpre. Joseph Biden, in his recently announced infrastructure bill, included $4 to $5 billion for community programming theoretically designed to address community violence. In the COVID-19 era, we have seen a spike in shootings in many major metropolitan areas around the country, and there is real demand for grassroots organizations for funding to address the root causes of violence. If you go to the website for the coalition that is formed to advocate for this money to go to some of the grassroots organizations, Fund Peace, you'll see folks like Steve Kerr and Kamau Bell and well-known activists like Tamika Mallory all rallying around this federal investment in different localities around the country. And when I actually looked at the bill for the infrastructure for the parts relating to violence prevention, I was pretty stunned that besides a few dozen million dollars for different pilot programs around the country, it doesn't actually seem to be a lot of that investment designed to go to grassroots community organizations through new allocations of funds. He's just expanding existing funding for existing programming and making old pots of money available to new organizations. And the sad thing, I wasn't surprised. What we call violence prevention has really become a catch-all term for many people who are well-established in the human social service ecosystem to rebrand their work as needing to be seen with the kind of urgency which with cities around the country have traditionally viewed funding the police. So in the era of so-called defund the police, these existing human social service entities have, with some exceptions, largely rebranded their existing programming to call itself violence prevention and open up a new pot of money, but more importantly, a new pot of social capital and credibility to their approaches. There are specifically designed interventions for violence prevention, things like Cure Violence out of Chicago, which is being replicated around the country, that do good work in terms of preventing retaliation by actually engaging brothers in the street. But for years, we in the community here in Baltimore City, long plagued with a violence epidemic, have wondered, what are the larger structural factors engaging violence? What are the solutions our community has indigenously come up with over decades? And looking at the people who run many of the nonprofits who call themselves the leaders in violence prevention, it's pretty stunning that very few of them look like the people committing the violence. Very few of them openly claim to use a methodology informed by African culture or in-depth understanding of the people committing the violence, and many of them actually look like traditional corporate top-down nonprofits, and really they are straight out of the white top-down academic playbook. So we're really dealing with a tight conundrum where folks seeking to graft on the credibility of the academy, places like Hopkins and Harvard, are basically using this claims of having an evidence-based, academically approved methodology to graft onto work that people on the ground are doing, but without actually interrogating that work, interrogating the larger political economy on who's actually benefiting from this new violence interruption movement. And all of the other factors of violence, trauma, slavery, wealth inequality, poverty are just being left off the table so we can get some more money for programs, which is good, but can't we do better? This talk was really three or four years in the making, so please excuse it for being long. Also, consider this part two of what I meant to get to last year, pandemic disrupted my plans, part two of the so-called public health hustle that I'd been teasing by calling the original podcast part one. So this is about public health infrastructure, the public health movement, and what I see is the co-option of grassroots social justice movements and the co-option of the defund the police calls into a largely top-down nonprofit model of violence prevention. It's designed to showcase our work as researchers here at LBS, which is part of our organizational business plan, but it's really designed to put out an in-depth researched argument against some of the assertions that have been so difficult to push back against from traditional top-down academic violence prevention nonprofits. So again, this is a long-ranging talk talking about a bunch of different issues from America to Colombia to movement work to movement infrastructure to the in-depth analysis of the research behind cognitive behavioral therapy, and why all this stuff matters, and what the stakes are in terms of gentrification, in terms of who has power in our communities, and how we can actually address at a root level the deep community need to solve the issue of street violence. So with that, thank you. Please stay tuned. I know the talk is long, but we want to come back for a little bit more discussion in the conclusion about some plans we have for the future of In Search of Black Power, and we hope you enjoy the talk. Very much. Glad we've been able to get started basically on time for all my attempts to keep the presentation shorter. I'm realizing I've been researching this stuff for about 5 years and that this talk actually hits on a lot of different things. It hits on politics, research, youth development, criminal justice, defund the police, international relations. And I'm going to try to weave all that together in roughly an hour. But the larger impetus of the talk was to explain to folks the role that research serves at LBS in our methodology. LBS is not a nonprofit. We do a lot of advocacy work, and part of the idea is that we are able to make money off of fee-for-service contracts that are not people paying us to do nonprofit advocacy. So one thing that I do as director of research, in addition to generally facilitating and assisting with research campaigns, with research and doing advocacy on different issues like cannabis legalization, built on that research, is also do research for different entities, different foundations, different individuals, and bring our methodology of the research we use through our work to other people who want to use that methodology. And that allows us to fund our organization on a fee-for-service basis without taking money directly to do the advocacy. So you don't want to advocate for what a foundation wants to pay you to advocate for. You want to get money to be able to advocate for whatever you want to advocate for based on the research you do. And this talk is largely designed to explain why that is so important. And I wanted to pick an issue that shows our research methodology and allows us to talk about one of the most important issues facing our community, which is violence. A lot of people are talking about defund the police, and there's this fallacious assumption that there is a dichotomy between talking about how to address the violence in our community and talking about defund the police. This talk is designed to show that you actually have to do both at the same time. That should kind of be obvious, but for some reason it isn't. And let's just get into it. Tried my best to include everything that needed to be included. But this is actually a picture of Molly Baldwin. She runs a nonprofit called Roca, which does work in Boston and Baltimore. She's getting some interesting looks from the people around her as she talks about how to address street violence in largely Black and Brown communities. And I think that's the thing I want you to take from this talk is a very magnified sentiment of looking askance when someone not from your community and doesn't share and end up understanding the history and culture of your community comes into your community and tells you how to solve a problem. But we'll get more into that towards the end. So a basic theory of research. So research is political, and research tends to function on the industry of research that LBS is a part of as a for-profit entity. We're trying to do our own role in relation to this research game, this research political landscape. So research is political. There are these think tanks like the Center for American Progress, which is a liberal think tank. This is the Clinton think tank. And they do all these policy papers and all these smart people do all these promotions that are usually centered on social justice, but within a free market framework. And they do battle with the conservative think tank. So, of course, that's the Heritage Foundation. Both of these are multi-billion dollar foundations. And they have nonprofits. They have what you could call a thrivalry. So they pretend to beef with each other. But in reality, they're basically taking the same political assumptions and applying different ways to view them. For example, take Obamacare. Obamacare comes from the Conservative Heritage Foundation. It is a free market, pro-business, pro-health industry view of healthcare that the Center for American Progress takes up and tries to spin that into a left-wing progressive campaign. And they battle with each other. They have, you know, basically fake rat beef. But all the time, they're going to conferences. They're getting paid to do all this research, and they're trying to influence policymakers with the research they do. So we try to intervene into this dynamic, and I'll give you a specific example. So this is a report done by Human Rights Watch and ACLU, which talks about the toll of drug criminalization in America.
And this is what researchers tend to do. They get brought in to do a gig. So Human Rights Watch and ACLU, they may have done this report, but oftentimes they will pay someone from the outside to come in and consult or actually do the research for them. And they'll take this report to conferences. They'll fly all over the country, obviously pre-pandemic, talking about we have this new innovative analysis of the harms of criminalization to do things like advocate for drug decriminalization. I'm not saying drug decriminalization is a bad thing. What I'm saying is that what we try to do is what they want us to do is they want to go to someone like LBS and say, here's what you advocate for, the stuff in this report. And you go to your state house and advocate for the stuff that we want you to advocate for. We want to say no and say, we're not advocating for what you want us to advocate for. We'll do our own research, come up with our own policy proposals. And if you want us to help you do that research, pay us to help you figure out what you should be telling people to advocate for. So for an example, I'm actually doing research on a research project on drug decriminalization. And one thing I realized that I'm very happy I did not advocate for the version of drug decriminalization that the report told me to advocate for, because their report was using the Portugal model. And the Portugal model has this drug decriminalization methodology that in my research I found was basically a replication of drug courts. And if you know anything about drug courts in America, it's that they basically replicate the same punitive anti-Black vision of criminal justice that they were supposed to solve. And this Portugal model is being praised as the most progressive model for drug decrim. And to me, it just looks like a new drug court. I haven't heard anybody say that. I haven't seen that in the research. And that's why I do research, to be able to find stuff like this out so that I'm not stuck advocating for the Portugal model because I need the money to do an advocacy contract. I can get paid to do the research and tell Human Rights Watch or ACLU, maybe you should rethink the Portugal model because that might just be a new drug court. So that's the idea. It's to let people know we do this service and to explain this is what we bring to the table. It's because we actually do advocacy on the ground, we can understand some of these the limitations of these theoretical interventions and bring our own perspective to the issue. So obviously we've done a lot of work on the issue of community violence and policing, and that kind of goes into this talk, which is roughly divided into three parts. It's going to be all over the place, but yeah, roughly three parts. Part one, Black community responses to violence. I'm going to start with the solutions. The only way you understand the solutions and the research around the solutions does the actual discourse around violence prevention look crazy. And I was stunned how bad the research was. It wasn't just bad, it was not surprising, but this is like one of the most important issues to our community. And the lack of seriousness and rigor, which the dominant mainstream academic and nonprofit establishment takes this issue, was frankly appalling. And I wanted to, first of all, as an African-centered researcher, I want to focus on solutions, and I want to start with the solutions our community has produced, so then you can understand how the dominant nonprofit solutions look in comparison to what I'm presenting to you at the beginning, and how the research looks, so you can compare the research. And the research is crazy, but we'll get to that. So we're going to use a larger political context, because this is a larger political issue. So this is, we're going to start with a little bit about the conversation around defund the police, because the defund the police conversation is directly connected to the violence conversation. As you can see, U.S. population has increased moderately over the past 20 years. Funding for police has absolutely exploded, far disproportionate to the actual population growth. Most of that is at a state and local level. So we're looking at state and local solutions to this police funding issue. There's a problem with this, though. Here's actually polling data around the issue of defund the police. Do you support or oppose the movement known as defund the police? It only has a 28% support rating amongst Black people. So what's happening here that we have this movement that everyone's claiming it's from the grassroots, everyone claiming represents the people, but have only 28% support amongst Black people? Let's go a little deeper. When you change the question from do you support the movement defund the police to should we take a portion of the budget for your police in your community and redirect those funds to social services, it goes up to 63%. Now, if you take one thing away from the talk, what they want you to focus on is social services in that question. What I want you to focus on is community. Because the issue isn't just funding any social services. They can be as much the problem as the solution, which this whole talk is designed to explain. But the desire for community control is what I think is so attractive and what actually boosts that number up to 63. So let's go a little bit deeper here. Why is this such a big deal? Because of the pandemic, violence is spiking in major cities around the country. You can see it here in the graphic. But it's actually coming from an extremely low baseline. Crime has been dropping precipitously in America for the past 30 years. As you can look at those, look at all those drops, pilot motivation per 100,000 people. The bottom has fallen out of violent crime over the past 30 years, and it's going up from a very low baseline. Here's the problem. People's perception of crime has largely been entirely disconnected from the actual experience of crime. So you can see that even if crime declined over all that time, people's feelings of being unsafe have actually increased. So that's a concern that with the boost in murder rates, which again is coming from a very low baseline, that's going to suck up the impetus for defund the police. So it's not just a question of how do we solve the murders, it's how do we win defund the police in the midst of a murder spike. So this is the reality of the issue. But why is the baseline support for defund the police so low? So this should be not surprising to most people on this talk. An analysis of homicide victimization by race, you can see Black victimization of homicide is very, very high compared to other races. Now, like the woke talking point is like police don't provide safety and white people commit crimes too. That's true. But working class Black people in urban areas, they see this in their lived experience. People they know are dying. So you just can't say police don't solve the problem. You need to tell them what does. Here's also the issue is that we as a community have tried to solve our problems with violence ourselves many times in our history. And many of the people, frankly, who are now talking about defund the police are totally disconnected from that history and are pairing up with people who actively work to destroy that history. So many people will know about this experiment in the early 90s. This is the Nation of Islam. Got contracts to do security in housing projects all throughout the country in the early 90s. And this is a Baltimore Sun article saying community respects armed Nation of Islam guards. So this is actually the community was satisfied with this service they were providing because they felt it was working. This real life replaced the police with grassroots community services. And many of the people saying defund the police don't even know this happened, aren't connected to the people who did this, and are actually hostile to many of the people who did this work. Because look what happened. 2 years later, New York Times says Muslim guards stop work in Baltimore because of the political backlash to the Nation of Islam. Now, many of the people saying defund the police weren't alive at this time, but they aren't connected to the people who were. They aren't connected to community organizations who were there to see this battle. And more importantly, they aren't precise about the problem with what happens when you say fund social services. Because when you say defund the police, fund the community, the experience of many Black people on the ground, literally, is this is what happens. So this is the Orchestra Arts Program, literally calling itself a violence prevention program by giving kids violins. Now, I support giving kids violins, but there's something called creaming, where most of the folks who are going to go to a violin class aren't exactly your target demographic for preventing murders. But because we as a community don't have control over our narrative, they get to sell orchestra kids as a violence prevention program when it's really just an enrichment program. But of course, calling it a violence prevention program helps push orchestra kids so it can get more funding for doing so-called violence prevention. Now, this is the part that I don't have time to go into in depth, but I want folks to understand that the frustration with the lack of control over the social service sector is actually juxtaposed to the seemingly minor but real control many middle-class Black folks feel they have over the police department. Obviously, community policing is not the solution. It's designed to suck up community input and give the illusion of control. But there are times where police have to go to community associations and get yelled at, get screamed at. They have to know those folks' names. There's a degree of actual democratic political negotiation between the cops and some of those folks in community. Not all of them, but some of them. And there's none of that with orchestra kids. There's none of that with the ABLE Foundation. There's none of that with the human social service organizations that many people are trying to sell them as the solution to violence. So people from the community say, look, I know the cops aren't the solution, but I can actually control that. If you're bringing in these organizations that have no accountability to my community, I can't control anything. So I'm not just going to say defund the police because I don't know what I'm getting in return. It's not just that they haven't gotten anything in return. It's not just they've only gotten policing. It's that what they've gotten in terms of social services has been so bad, so not controlled by them, that they are skeptical that just putting money into something called social services is actually a solution to violence. And that part is completely off the table for the conversation for defund the police, where it needs to be at the core of the conversation, which is why I'm giving this talk. So what is the solution to violence? And again, I wanted to try to start here, hit here hard, to show you the difference. This, as many of you will know, is Amos Wilson, a very well-known African-centered academic. He worked out of City University in New York in the 90s, unfortunately died relatively young in his 50s in the 90s. But he did a work called Black on Black Violence, Psychosocial Dynamics of Black Self-Annihilation, the Service of White Domination. And he wrote something that we at LBF actually cite all the time in the violence conversation. I'm just going to read it to you. White racist American society harboring a poorly concealed death wish against its Black captives generally leaves but a few outlets for the release of societally provoked Black male rage, all inappropriate. They include the abject suppression to oppression, neurosis by drug or religion, deliberate ignorance, upending, unwarranted protests, futile sub rosa grumbling, over compensatory status driving, criminality, and homicidal attacks on other Black males or on himself, suicide. Having internalized white racist values and attitudes, having been possessed of his injected white racist demon, the suicidal African-American blames his victimized self. Identified with his implanted alien spirit, he harbors a death wish against the victims of white racist oppression, amongst whom he himself is numbered. Looking at the world through jaundiced white racist eyes, he sees the enemy, and the enemy is himself. So that's Dr. Wilson arguing that the murder epidemic we see in Black communities is the externalization of a suicidal impulse. And this person is dismissed as a quack, as a hotep, as someone who did not do much empirical research. Well, he wasn't funded to do much empirical research. And frankly, I said this was a good, useful analytical frame, but the empirical reality of it, I was skeptical of. Then I saw this. So let's look at the actual ratios of homicide to suicide in male ethnic groups. In the white community, for every one white male homicide, there are five white male suicides, a 1-to-5 ratio. In the Black male community, for every one white male suicide, guess how many Black male homicides there are? Same 1-to-5 ratio. And that comes from Mark Rosenberg in 2013. And when I saw this, of course, the first thing I thought was Amos Wilson. But most people who listen to NPR aren't thinking about Amos Wilson, so they don't know the implications of hearing him talk about this. So actually seeing the ratio of white male suicide to Black male homicide is the beginnings of empirical proof for this powerful, powerful reconceptualization of how we understand violence in our community. As the externalization of that internalized self-hatred, the solution is to deal with that self-hatred and produce productive outlets to restore a sense of value in self. Similarly, this, of course, is Naeem Akbar. He is a still living professor at Florida State University in the psychology department. He talks about the needing to embrace the notion of resistance as a positive pro-social adaptation, as opposed to pathologizing it and seeing it only as the anti-social adaptation. So the desire to strike out against your oppressors is natural and productive. So let's give folks productive outlets for that, as opposed to pathologizing that, which, spoiler alert, I argue most violence prevention programming actually does. But again, I'm a researcher. I look at data. Effects of two prevention programs on high-risk behavior among African-American youth, a 2004 article, primary researcher Brian Flay. Let's look at the data. So these are two African-centered interventions juxtaposed to a non-African-centered intervention done longitudinally over many different years with a cohort of middle school students numbering in the hundreds. So this is a large sample size, control group compared data test for African-centered interventions. And what does it say? For boys, the SDC and SCI, the African-centered interventions, significantly reduced the rates of increase in violent behavior by 35 and 47% compared to HEC, the non-African-centered intervention. This is what you rarely see this. I've only seen this once, which shows you the lack of ability for the academy to respect this knowledge base. An actual comparison to not just nothing at the intervention, but a non-African-centered program teaching essentially the same information. And this is the distinction in results. This is incredible. This is an incredible evidence-based proof of the theory from Akbar and Wilson. But it's even better than that. The effect of our program may be understood because of its design of our control conditions. We want to design the placebo attention condition that would include providing some of the same attention to the students of the SDC. We probably erred on the side of making the HEC too similar to the SDC, and that the HEC included some of the same skills as the SDC. That means that the HTC may have been more effective than a standard placebo attention condition. If so, this would mean our reported results underestimate the actual effectiveness of our programming. So what did all that just mean? It actually shows an African consent methodology. So they actually did a control group, but they said, I don't want to give them nothing. I want to give them the same information. And they actually basically made the control group too good. I would argue probably because they didn't want to leave those kids with a crappy program. So they actually made the control group, the HEC, essentially similar to the SDC and the SDI. And that actually shows why the results weren't even more in favor of the African-centered program. And I think that just shows you a real African-centered research methodology of caring about the youth in your study to not want to give them crappy programming, even if when it made your results look better by comparison. So this is what actual African-centered research looks like when you care. And then we're going to show you the research being presented today about violence prevention. So some more analysis here. We have to go to the macro, not just to the micro. This is a fantastic book called Black Power at Work, talking about the importance of minority contractors who did construction in the 60s and 70s. So there's this huge movement, because they were excluded from the unions, of Black minority contractors building skyscrapers, giving money for urban development, and building hundreds of buildings all over the country, employing thousands of people, despite being frozen out from the credit markets, despite being resisted by the racist unions. And people view these folks essentially as conservative Black capitalists. This book really explains the reality of that they were actually building with revolutionary movements in Detroit. They were arguing for fundamental reinvestment on a massive scale in the Black community. They were politically organized, and they were also arguing for essentially a fundamental redistribution of wealth through investing in folks like them. Their biggest opponents were actually the unions, because these are Black folks independently doing a business, not union work. They were actually resisted by the unions. Of course, the credit agencies did not want to give them loans. And Nixon, as opposed to embracing them with his so-called Black capitalism, Nixon actually, of course, threw them to the side because he thought he didn't need them anymore after the white racist union hard hat rebellion in the 70s. So what does this mean? This means that actually investing money at a massive scale in our community is a huge tool for entrepreneurship and job creation, which studies show can actually be a good way to suck people who would otherwise be on the street committing violent crimes to give them something productive to actually manifest their desire in the world. So this is actually the scale of the minority set-aside programs. This is, you know, Perrin Mitchell, minority set-asides, $40 billion a year went to minority communities through minority set-asides. That's 10 times more money than the NFL clears in profit. That's just how big that program was. That wasn't just some random Black capitalist slush fund. That was employing people on the ground, giving people jobs, and potentially keeping people from murdering each other. So this is empirical research done by Karen Parker, remember that name, on the crime drop that I showed you before. One of the things that she argues explains it is higher rates of African-American entrepreneurship is correlated with lower rates of youth, juvenile, violent crime arrests. So we have clear empirical data that Black business creation is something that can deter murders. I'm not a Black capitalist. I'm just going where the data shows me. Now, what actually gets people to create businesses? Minority set-asides. This is from David Blanchflower, professor at Dartmouth, minority self-employment in the United States and the impact of affirmative action. Evidence is presented for construction, which had self-employment rates roughly double the national rates. The construction sector is also important given the existence of public sector affirmative action programs at the federal, state, and local levels. So specifically, construction contractors are full of independent business owners. And as we see, if you invest through things like affirmative actions, through redirecting money from the state, you can actually increase Black business creation. Look at that graph. So over the course of a certain amount of time, 5 years after the affirmative action minority set-aside programs kick in, Black business creation actually exceeds white male Black business creation. Very rare to find that in the data at scale, at a large scale. And why am I doing this? Not because I'm so smart. It's because people told me, man, Perrin Mitchell took care of us. When we had those construction jobs, things were better. That's the what you hear talking to working class Black people, old heads on the street. So as opposed to just dismissing them as, you know, old fogies who are seduced by Black nationalist garb, actually researched it, and I found out they were right. So when you actually respect the analysis of people on the ground, you can go to the literature and find interventions that actually address the problems people are looking to address. Unfortunately, I don't think that's happening very much in much of the nonprofit violence prevention conversation. So if you want to know who to support, Coach Chakalia Center. It's run by Baba Adamola, someone who many of us will know well. They actually go to people using a public health infused methodology. It's not only public health. When people are shot up or stabbed up, they go to them in the hospital and say, hey, you can go back out, commit more, be a person who commits crime or becomes another victim of crime, or we can take you through a rites of passage program. They have 18 people that like them on Facebook. Now, I'm not saying that that alone is a metric of success, but it is useful to think about that they're doing this great work and people don't know about it. Baltimore Brothers, I mean, this is Captain Andrew. Folks, many of them affiliated with the Nation of Islam, are bringing that work from the 90s into the 2020s, doing work on the ground, in addition to other folks like Marvin McKinstry and folks in the community doing their own things in different ways. They have 175 folks on Facebook. Not a metric in and of itself, but I just want to juxtapose that to what many people on this call probably have heard of as Cure Violence. They, of course, have 12,000 people following them on Facebook. So what is Cure Violence? Why do they matter? And why does it seem like, you know, this group that many people haven't heard about directly has so much more shine than the people doing the work on the ground? So let's go to part two. The Academy hustles violence prevention. So we're going to start off with the video, and we're going to try to get into some of the analysis around some of the things that are happening. So this is Cure Violence doing their analysis on their methodology. Now, brief disclaimer. I know many of the folks, Black folk on the ground, are doing whatever they want to do, despite the white public health establishment essentially controlling violence interruption. So we're talking about violence interrupters. The video will explain their methodology. And I know folks are doing, in many ways, African-centered methodologies on their own. This is not a critique of them. This is a critique of the infrastructure that I think is holding them back and hustling off of their hard work. And in some ways, I didn't want to talk about it because the whole thing is like, well, just let those folks hustle. White folks going to do what they're going to do. But actually reading what these folks say they're doing and knowing how wrong it is, I really think we have to understand it. The folks are building an industry off the hard work people are doing on the ground. And we have to understand how that's happening, why that's happening, be able to explain the ways they're trying to co-opt things like defund the police into this work, and be able to explain what the difference is. So let's start by actually seeing how they describe what they do at Cure Violence.
Violence doesn't happen one case at a time. Violence doesn't happen one case at a time. One act of violence leads to another, and another, and another. It spreads like a virus. When one person becomes infected, it can spread to the whole community. The way we're currently trying to reduce the spread of violence is expensive. People are still dying. What if we looked at violence differently? What if we treated it like a contagious disease? Some cities are doing that right now, using violence interrupters. People train just like health workers who treat epidemics. They find the source of the violence and intervene with nonviolent solutions. They look for those who have been exposed or at the highest risk, and they help change the behaviors and norms that allow violence to spread. The results are amazing. When this was first started in one community in Chicago, shootings dropped by 67%. New Orleans went 200 days without a murder. In one Brooklyn community, the program resulted in an entire year without one shooting. And it's not just in the U.S. Around the world, lives are saved and communities change when we stop the spread of violence by using a health approach. Together, we can cure violence. Learn more and take action at takepart.com/violentyear.
Okay, so that's a lot. Very high production value. And it's intuitively hard to argue against. Who can argue against stopping violence? But if you just listen to the rhetoric and language presented, you can get some of the inklings of what I'm talking about. It's like we need to change the norms. Like the norms themselves are disease, not the people suffering from oppression. Violence is a disease. So are the people doing violence diseased? And what are you saying about those people? Right? So in the way we talk about this public health approach, we have to understand some of the things that are happening here. So let's actually look at the data. So this is a analysis of safe streets in Baltimore, done by Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Again, it's a public health intervention that uses violence interruption as a methodology. So let's look at the data from Baltimore. I'm not a statistician. I'm not vouchsafing that all my analysis is perfect, but I'm not stupid either. Right. So let's actually look at the data. This is the McKeldry Park neighborhood. And this starts in 07 to 09. No murders. And this is the baseline. Compare that to the baseline. There are murders. Right. So this looks extremely persuasive in the abstract. But actually look at the y-axis. So it's like 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. It's an extremely small scale. So it makes the results look way more impressive than they might look otherwise. This is a small community, and having no murders is good, but I want to look deeper into the data. So let's look at figure 2. This is the actual shootings in McKeldry Park for that same time period. And as you can see, the blue line is before the Safe Streets intervention. And you can see the dotted line, Safe Streets kicks in. There was an initial drop, but then look at the rebound effect for shootings. So the shootings go up even higher after Safe Streets comes in than before. And my father was a cop in Baltimore. So there's some things that I've just been taught to think about that may be different than other folks. So one thing people always say is like, it's kind of random who gets saved and who doesn't when you get shot. So you can have, for example, shock trauma is a very, very high tech medical intervention that saves a lot of people. So if shock trauma is just saving a lot of people who would otherwise die, then you get no murders. Those people still might be getting shot, as we can see here in the intervention. Now, it doesn't mean that the initial drop is meaningless. It just means, or the secondary drop afterwards is meaningless. It's just, it's not what I saw in that first video, which is this overwhelming, incontrovertible data. That's not what I'm seeing here. Let's do a little bit more. So, and this is basically, in some ways, pro-safe streets. This is the data from a different site, Madison Eastern. Pre-safe streets, you have homicide incidences, and post-safe streets, you have homicide incidences, in some cases higher than pre-safe streets. So that obviously doesn't look as good. But if you look at the shooting data, they do have a decrease in shootings, non-fatal incidences, that is, not shootings. So the data is not as overwhelming as they want you to believe it is. So like, is it shootings or is it homicides? Because they'll use the decrease in shootings to claim that Madison Eastern was a success, but then they'll use the drop in homicides to explain that the McKeldry Park one was a success. So which one is it, right? So what I know is that other places like Cherry Hill have had really, really good results, but that in many ways was despite the Hopkins public health infrastructure, not because of it. It's because folks in the community who had organic buy-in with those folks in Cherry Hill, and they really bought into the program as a community. In some other places, you bring it in, it's just another program. So they're selling it like it is their public health approach, which is making this stuff effective, when in reality, it's just the community buying in to doing some of the work that we talked about with the Nation of Islam, that we talked about with the program in Chicago, in addition to Safe Streets. Safe Streets wants to cure violence, of which Safe Streets uses their model. Cure violence seems to want to make you believe that it's just them. That's just not the case. Data doesn't show that. Another example of the problem. So this is, I talk about this a lot, because I think it's very demonstrative of the pathologization within the model. So this was, emphasis on was, something called the call-in, where they basically bring everyone together and they say, look, we know that you are violent people. You just got out of jail. If you don't put your guns down and go riot, we're going to toss you into the jail. But if you go straight, we're going to promise you to get you connected to services and jobs. So this is like the carrot and stick approach that they use, like from, you know, behavioral psychology, the Harvard people are really into this. And to me, if you understand anything about what Amos Wilson just said, this is absolutely ridiculous. If you've internalized a notion of deviance and people come to you saying, I think you're a deviant, people are going to lash out and say, okay, you think I'm a thug? I'm going to prove that I'm a thug. And shockingly enough, now, there were many problems with the 2007 implementation of Safe Streets, but this is the last time I've actually heard them using the call-in model in Baltimore. And according to Baltimore City Health Department staff and Cure Violence consultants, they're experiencing significant difficulties implementing the program. And it's a big sordid story with many different nuances, But I think one of them was they tried to do a call-in and people basically said, F you. And they've tried to do multiple different call-ins in Baltimore, to my understanding, none of them have worked. And I think that the Amos Wilson analysis actually explains why that model didn't work here in Baltimore. Maybe it works amongst non-African people committing violence. I don't know if it works very well, if we understand what Amos Wilson said to be true. But continuing to wrap up with the cure of violence model, so this is their actual explanation of what they do. Let's do some rhetorical analysis of what they're saying here. So culturally appropriate, not culturally liberatory, not built off the work of Amos Wilson, culturally appropriate, like don't call people out the name, don't be overly familiar. You know, cultural appropriateness is good. It's not cultural liberation. It's not African-centered. It's not built upon a deep understanding of the culture of the people there. Access to highest risk. This is not broad-based care for the community. This is targeted care for the people who are most likely to commit violence. Provide treatment. Again, not necessarily jobs, not necessarily resocialization, not community reintegration, treatment, i.e. human social service treatment. But the big thing is change behaviors. So we're going to get to this a little bit at the end. It's the individualizing and pathologizing of individual people because violence is a disease. We have to interrupt the spread of violence by interrupting the behavior. Here's a little thought experiment for you. If violence is a disease in America, who is patient zero? Who is the original vector for violence in America? You know, maybe you have an answer, maybe you don't, but I think that this guy is number one on my list. Of course, that's Christopher Columbus. So we don't talk about literally them bringing smallpox to America at the beginning of the epidemic of violence. We don't talk about the slavery and the genocide at the beginning of the violence epidemic in America. We want to go to brothers in the hood and tell them they're diseased. I'm not buying it. And frankly, I think many people who are close to the programming share similar sentiments, but haven't been able to express them as freely. Let's go a little bit deeper though. Gangs. Gangs are the problem. Gangs are dangerous. What's a big gang of Baltimore? The Black Gorilla Family. Big, scary black men, like gorillas. Gorillas are actually vegetarians and very calm. But in the American context of prison gangs, Gorilla Family, dangerous, committing murders. This is not to defend the Black Gorilla Family, but look at that spelling of the word gorilla with a O. It's funny because when I heard Black Gorilla Family, I know that that's weird because the Black Gorilla Family I know was started by revolutionary George Jackson and was spelled guerrilla in terms of the anti-fascist fighters in the Spanish Civil War. So many liberation fighters around the world call themselves guerrillas, but in English, that's pronounced gorilla. So the Black Gorilla Family was started to defend Black people from racist prison guards in San Quentin, where revolutionary George Jackson was held. It was designed to fight the violent imperialist forces and to express the anger and frustration of Black men in a productive way. Of course, George Jackson is killed, the Black Panthers are destroyed through COINTELPRO, and the Black Gorilla Family then turns into more of a criminal gang. But if we don't understand the state violence that leads the BGF to be the BGF we see today and the understanding that the state needs to be accountable for the actual violence it did, not just to the individual freedom fighters, but to the communities that prevented the revolutionary consciousness of the Black guerrilla family from cultivating itself, then we're just going to blame Black folks and call them disease, not understanding that disease was injected into them through state violence. We're also not going to talk about this. This is actually LA deputies, sheriffs, police gangs with tattoos, with initiation rituals. We're not talking about this as being the epidemic for violence in our community. But it's the exact same thing as the scary black dude with a gorilla on his chest, except a white guy with a badge is doing it. So if we don't have a comprehensive understanding of violence, we can't cure it. But folks are going around calling themselves re-engineering community to a health systems prevention violence perspective. Look what's on the map. Healthcare, academics, faith-based institutions, public health universities, hospitals, behavioral care, Justice Department, social services, and community. They're in there too. So we have this comprehensive view of community, and look at these blue shirts, the blue-shirted violence interrupters, are just dispersed all throughout the community and in all these institutions. So all the institutions are benefiting, and the community is just an accoutrement to the larger vision that the health systems prevention of violence view wants to have for our community. And of course, this is leading to what we just heard about a month ago. Biden has proposed putting up to $5 billion into violence prevention, but through things like Cure Violence. And through things like the different community institutions that we just saw coordinating with Cure Violence, not Nation of Islam, obviously not the Black Gavilla family, not the program I told you about in Chicago with those incredible results, but for people who have connection to the power establishment, they're getting the bag. While we are left trying to defund the police without clearly articulating who we want the money to go to, and everybody on this list is saying, yes, hand up, yes, give money to me, please. And this is what happens when we don't have a research base that's actually emancipatory and built in the experiences of working class Black people to be able to prevent that co-option from happening. So let's look at the research. I'll try to be quick. This stuff can be dense, but I'm not doing it to show you the research. I'm showing you the political economy behind the research, right? So this is an article, Amplifying Community-Led Violence Prevention as a Counter to Structural Oppression. Jalen Alser, Chicago Creed, is one of the authors. And again, he's not from a university. He's from an actual violence prevention program. And that name is another name I want you to look out for, in addition to Karen Parker, that's going to come back up. So what are they doing? Seek Peace is a mobile app for 3 months with 56 street outreach workers, SOWs, and staff from 3 different organizations to 6 different sites across South and West sides of Chicago. So it's a cell phone app, you know. But how are they talking about it? What types of resources are shared? How do we create an infrastructure for this? How do we amplify street outreach work? They're basically claiming that their app is a capacity building for street outreach workers, which is like code word for, if you want to help them, give me money. And I think that we're going to substantiate that claim as we actually do the analysis. So here is the National Science Foundation grant that they got to do the app. Excuse that book just fell. $150K. And they got 5 grants. This is only one of the 5 grants they got from the National Science Foundation. Again, remember that name. And this is the app. I've actually done a little bit of app design. It's not easy. But remember, this is $250,000 for this app. And, you know, it doesn't look very impressive, but that's not necessarily here nor there. But so let's go a little bit deeper. 48 people actually installed the app, and they developed the app for Android only. So they got $250,000 for the app you can only use on Android. I'm not saying it's easy to put things on iPhone. I know it's hard to sideload stuff. But if you gave me $250,000, I'd probably get an app on iPhone, right? I'd probably have more than 46 people using it, too. That's a small data size compared to the 600 people we saw in the data set from Chicago when they were doing the African Center Youth Program. Let's actually continue to look at the data. This is the actual, these are pseudonyms, and these are the actual people posting. It's like 5 or 6 people doing most of the posting, and they're all like in their 60s. So I'm sorry, but it just feels like you've recreated Boomer Facebook for street outreach workers and called yourself doing emancipatory political work. So this is actually incredibly damning in my perspective for the actual value of the app, because like almost all the engagement is done by 6 people of your 48. But of course, they're not going to spend it that way. Here's what they say. Funding enables street outreach workers to do their prevention and healing work, which counters the harmful practices of traditional policing. Street outreach workers are frequently underfunded, yet criticized. Suggested the Street Peace app has the ability to document their work to demonstrate their efforts to outsiders, including potential funders. So again, we're talking about demonstrating for potential funders, but think about it like an Android app. The Android apps are free because they monetize your data. I argue that academics are doing a very similar thing with street outreach work. They want to collect the data so that they can continue to argue, hey, these people need support. I got $250,000 to do an Android app. How about I give me $500,000 to do an iPhone app? And then I got to do the databases. Then I got to do the user interface. Then I got to do the privacy protections. And it adds up to millions and millions of dollars of that $5 billion Biden is trying to allocate. Stuff like this app can suck up millions and millions of that dollar, so it doesn't actually get to the street outreach workers, because they're using all this emancipatory language to claim that their replication of Boomer Facebook is emancipatory support for street outreach workers. Another example, I don't like Facebook, Instagram. They're making a lot of money off of it. But if they watch it like they should, a lot of just violence that's going on wouldn't be happening. So there's people referencing sets on Facebook and Instagram causing beefs in the community, and the street outreach workers frustrated. But what they say is that street outreach workers recognize the trauma and harm that traditional social media platforms cause and appreciate the SP app for its privacy. This is why you have to fund me, and they can't just use a Facebook app, Facebook Messenger group, signal chain, because we have the privacy and they monetize your data, and that's bad for privacy. And it's like, well, you're essentially offering their data to funders through your evaluations and reports. Is that really that different, right? But yeah, here's some of the landing. By enacting transformative justice, street outreach workers are building a counterstructure against the racist systems and institutions that created the inequities that catalyzed violence in our community. Street outreach to leverage the trust and relationships with each other through the SP app and extend their counterstructural practices online. The direct communication across sites and organizations that the app enables was important because a counterstructure is built from the bottom up. Why is this academic analysis sounding like a sophomore at the new school, like some woke Twitter teen? Well, you're supposed to be a data person. You're supposed to be a technology person. It's because they understand this is what funders want. Funders want to feel they're doing the social justice thing. But actually funding the Nation of Islam, for example, is scary. Funding Baltimore Brothers is scary. Funding the DePaul Center for Technology and Social Change is not scary. But they want to have all their rhetoric of doing radical social change while not actually giving money to the grassroots. And this article allows them to do that. Given that street outreach work has now expanded to 30 Chicago communities, since recent increases in funding and shifts in state and local approaches to violence, a long-term pilot with more sustained support for integrating the SP app into work practices will be necessary to further evaluate the tool's potential to amplify street outreach practices. Give me money. This is not an academic article. This is a grant proposal. That's how a lot of the academy works. I'm not necessarily critiquing the academics for doing that. But compare that to what I showed you before about people doing longitudinal 4 or 5 year analysis with 1,000 kids. This ain't that. And frankly, this is not the thing you do when you take people suffering seriously. This is what you do when you see an opportunity to extend your academic career. So let's go a little bit deeper. Because unfortunately, this just keeps happening. Every article I found was basically a grant proposal masquerading as an academic analysis of violence prevention, which really pissed me off. So now you have to listen to what drove me crazy over the past month. So I'll try to be quick. Artificial intelligence and inclusion, formerly gang-involved youth as domains for experts for analyzing unstructured Twitter data. So what does all this mean? What's going on? So this data set contains the last 200 tweets of 279 users from neighborhoods of Chicago with high rates of violence. These users are chosen based on communication with a seed user, Lucretia Barnes, and the top 14 communicators on Twitter network. Lucretia was a self-identified gang member in Chicago before her death in April 2014. So this is one woman who died in a gang-related murder, and they're analyzing her tweets to see if people are using Twitter to basically do gang activities. So first of all, the fact that somebody died, I feel like should be more the focus here. It kind of feels like hustling off of people suffering. But everyone who tweets at a gang member is not a gang member. Gang members are our friends, our cousins, our family. People like to play online. So the idea that you're analyzing this Twitter set, like all these people are gang related is not doing gang activity or at the core of driving violence in a community. Also, even in 2014, I don't feel like real gangsters were using Twitter. They're using IG, they're using other stuff. And one person in one data set, they're building the entire academic theory based on one person in one data set. That's not, to me, super sound academic praxis. Let's see what they talk about. So they're actually taking slang tweets and basically decoding them for academic establishment to basically claim they have some magical algorithm to detect who's saying what in gang code to like the tech admin so they can report it and they can track people potentially doing violence online. But what are they actually catching? What are they saying? So let's actually look at what the tweets say. If you get caught, just never snitch. One day you're coming home 100. So you actually have to interpret this for an academic audience. The person is saying if they get caught doing an unlawful crime, there's no point in telling on the next man because eventually you'll be released from jail and face the repercussions for having told. This person is speaking from prior knowledge, which is why he is using the 100 emoji. So two things wrong with that statement. First, the assumption that the problem is repercussions, that we're going to hurt you for snitching. That's part of it. But the other part of it is that there's a code that says we're all doing dirt together. So if we're all doing dirt together, selling drugs, why are you snitching on somebody else when you were doing the same dirt they were doing? So it's a code of honor and respect and just a recognition that isn't necessarily always meaning I'm going to retaliate against you for cooperating. So they're projecting violence onto something that might just be like, hey, it's real messed up that you're a hypocrite. Also, the 100 emoji is not personal experience. Like, it kind of is, but it's really not. 100 is like, I'm keeping it 100. I'm totally truthful in my statement. That's not necessarily personal experience. It's just, I know what I'm saying is true. So even their so-called academic interpretations of street slang, I don't buy it. But it gets even worse. Jay smoking, thinking about D money, sad emoji, praying hands emoji, blood emoji. So this to me is like thinking about D money, smoking a J, I'm sad. And D money was killed by a cop. So that's what the article says. But what the academic analysis says, this is code for the tweeter basically saying that they shot someone named J. And they're taunting the rival gang by pointing out that they made Jay smoke by putting bullets in them. Even though the article also says this person often tweets about smoking weed as smoking a Jay. I can't say for sure this is bullshit, but I think it's bullshit. I think that they are making stuff up to make it appear that Twitter is the cesspool of gang activity because they know that's going to freak out the tech community so they can get more money researching this stuff. They claim to have people on the ground who are giving them information. And this could be them taunting a rival gang, but it could be some kids saying, these academics believe any stupid stuff we tell them. What's the stupidest thing we can tell them? Let's tell them that smoking the J is actually a code for street warfare. I think those are roughly equally likely options at this point. And this is not a scientific analysis of anything. This is people projecting their fears of Black youth using slang in a public space and building an academic career off of it. So it concludes, through our work, it seems there may not be one right answer for the meaning of social media posts, you think? Domain experts may not have the same interpretation and insights. Due to each expert experience the community and lives differently, we might just be making shit up. I don't know. This makes it challenging to measure domain expertise and the expansive or narrow nature of insights from domain experts. However, the complexity of social media communication can only be uncovered through the involvement of people who have knowledge of local culture, language, and changing nature of community climate. So pay me. I'm going to bring those folks together. And I'm going to help them interpret what's going on for you. Even though I just admit it, this all might be bullshit. And this is just a cornucopia of scary tweets that they just randomly put at the end of the article. Basically, it's just like the academic equivalent of a jump scare in a scary movie. It's like, hey, Twitter, there are street kids sending all this scary stuff on your platform. They could just be having fun, or they could be planning a gang war. If you want to find out, you got to pay me to teach you what's going on. And I'm sorry, this is when people say that this is an evidence-based methodology, this is the evidence. This is the academic journals they expect you to never read. And it's really annoying because, again, this is an issue that should have the highest standards for evidence analysis and has some of the lowest, apparently. But I've gotten bogged down. I'll try to be quick. So this is one last entrepreneurship program. This is Breaking the Cycle of Crime, Running Positive Social Spillover, Potential Entrepreneurship. This is a bunch of academics and this dude named Jay, excuse the pronunciation, Nwachu from Innovation Works. So again, this is a dude from a program with a bunch of academics analyzing violence. So what did they say? Furthermore, there is some evidence that entrepreneurship can produce crime. Parker 15, the same Parker I introduced you to at the beginning of the talk. That's good. That's how I found this article. But remember how I told you, like, my analysis of Parker was tied to macro level strategic change and reorienting to political economy. Their analysis of Parker's work isn't that. It's let's fund this entrepreneurship program, this entrepreneurship nonprofit in Baltimore. Innovation Works is one example of the intermediary seeking to facilitate entrepreneurship that builds community and reduces violence in Baltimore. Skip down. According to Jay Nwachu, the author of the article, who leads efforts at Innovation Works, incubators in Baltimore face extraordinary challenges. So all that analysis about fundamentally rejiggering the federal policy economy, about changing Black people's internalized self-hatred, they boil all that down to let's create a nonprofit and fund it. So that's what happens in this work. They're not wrong. They're taking the liberatory concepts that we present, boiling them down to their most amenable framework for the nonprofit industrial complex and hustling off our suffering with it. This isn't even a critique of Innovation Works. I'm just saying Innovation Works is not restoring a $44 million minority set-aside program. And until you do that, you're not really doing what the Parker literature says you need to do. But we're going to cite it to add juice to our grant proposal that we're just calling an academic article. This is how it concludes. Just like the last article, instead of scary tweets, I'm just going to randomly present the murder data from Baltimore. So this is raw data on murders from Baltimore. This is offensive. When you're doing an academic article, you're supposed to do like an algebraic analysis of, if we increase Black employment by this Black business by X amount, we know it has Y impact on murder rate. Let's take the murder rate and let's do a conversion off of, if we increased broad-based Black business creation by 10%, that lead to a 5% decrease in murders, a 10% decrease in murders. That's what you do when you really care. And you're actually trying to delve in the data and take it seriously. What you don't do is just randomly present the amount of murders in Baltimore and just say, well, Baltimore's crazy. So whatever we fund, it's got to maybe make stuff better, because look how crazy those numbers are. This is the same thing we saw before. At the end of the article, I'm just going to scare you with the murder rate, and that's going to add juice to my article. And declaring competing interests, none, which I believe. But let's go a little bit deeper in terms of what these folks are actually getting. Because don't get this twisted. This is the advertisement for Innovation Works. This guy's the academic article. And if I'm an academic, why do I do that? Let's find out. But violence interruption is big business. It's big business for the entire social service infrastructure. Because if they can claim to prevent violence, any amount of money we give, drug treatment, after school programming, it's all justified. So they all look at this new violence promotion public health proposal as a way to increase funding for their programming. Here's some proof. The R3 program is where they park 20% of the legal cannabis revenue in the state of Illinois. Illinois is legal cannabis. They have given 20% to a war on drugs preparation fund. Should be good, right? Here's an example of what they spend it on. Every program highlighted in blue calls itself violence prevention. Is there an in-depth evidence-based African-centered methodology, as we talked about before? No, it's the Girl Scouts. It is girls in the game, which is exactly what it sounds like, girls in sports. It's legal aid, not radical African-centered interventions in youth development. It's Monroe Foundation. Monroe Foundation just gives kids college scholarships. And you know, some college kids could be violent, but they're not the target demographic of violence prevention. They're just using the word violence prevention to get money all over the place. Millions of dollars getting sucked up for people to get money for shit they're already doing and calling it violence prevention. But so who did this? Who would give money to these folks? So let's look at the board of the Illinois R3 program. And if you look at the name, Jalen Arthur, the same person who authored the article that we started off this section with. Let's take a look at the brother. No, good looking young brother. Not saying he's not doing work, not saying he's not doing him. But look who he's on the board with. That name, many people will know, is Arne Duncan, former education secretary for Obama, best known for being an incredible basketball player, for winning the Celebrity All-Star Game MVP from Kevin Hart. This is the type of guy you run for governor of Illinois one day. This is the level of political muscle the Institutional Democratic Party wants to put behind the concept of violence prevention. And of course, why do you write articles on violence prevention? Because if you want to get NSF grants, people like Arne Duncan being on your team is a really, really good way to do that. This is not to say that violence prevention is inherently flawed, or that the academics are doing things that are necessarily improper. This is how people hustle off our suffering. This is the mechanics behind how it actually happens. We have academic articles that almost no one but people like me read, that are used to build social capital and lubricate connections to people like Arne Duncan, people like Jalen Arthur, who have political juice to do things like decide where millions of dollars in our communities go. And they have an incentive to put that money in places that are deemed politically safe, not places like the Nation of Islam, not places like Baltimore Brothers, not places that are doing the African-centered work, because that would challenge the monopoly of expertise that these folks have. But it actually gets worse than that. You might be trying to defund the police. I know we're running out of time. I tried to keep it to an hour. But the last part of this talk is to say, in the process of trying to defund the police, I'll just skip to the thesis statement of this section. You might be thinking of defunding the police, but you just might be making everything the police. Social workers become the police. Mental health care becomes the police. All in the name of defunding police. And that's where Rocha comes in. We started with Rocha. We're going to end with Rocha. From Boston, evidence-based programming, receiving millions of dollars to do work in Baltimore. Now, their methodology is a little bit different than Cure Violence. They focus a lot on service provision. They're not violence interrupters per se. They want to take people who could commit violence and put them in their wraparound service network. So they do this cognitive behavioral therapy programming that they claim gives people the space to intervene in moments where they could do violent thoughts. They give help for, education and job training. And they claim to have this evidence-based methodology to take people who otherwise commit violence and they don't commit violence. So let's look at CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Rocha uses it like a mantra, CBT. And I'll try to be quick. But what is cognitive behavioral therapy? It's kind of like what we talked about with Cure Violence. Your problems are all internalized. They're based upon learned patterns of unhelpful behavior. People suffering from psychological problems can learn better ways of coping to relieve their symptoms. It's all about the personal. It's all about your own internalized process of thinking being the problem. You see where I'm going with this, right? But let's look at the data. I'm a researcher. I want to present you with data. That's why I'm here. Meta-analysis of CBT with African-descended people. Of the 12 included studies, only two had large statistical effects favoring CBT for people of African descent. So of the 12 included studies, only two show that it works for Black folks. The data is there questioning this, but they go around screaming about evidence-based methodology demanding millions of dollars of your tax money. Let's go even deeper in the analysis. The authors found a significant ethnicity by treatment interaction for both outcome measures and post-hoc analysis, indicating differences only for African-American participants. Specifically, African-Americans assigned to CBT treatment had significantly higher depression scores at post-treatment than individuals from other ethnic backgrounds. So maybe blaming us for our oppression might make us worse. It's in the data. Cognitive behavioral therapy symptoms in African descent, a meta-analysis. Let's continue to go deeper here. More specifically, all anxiety disorders involve gratuitous irrational beliefs pertaining to the anticipation of an undesirable event occurring and other problems that would result if the undesirable event did take place. There are different potential events which could take place in the lives of a person of African descent that could invoke a legitimate anxious response. Maybe we're not crazy for being anxious. Maybe we have legitimate things to be anxious about. And maybe by you trying to beat that way of thinking out of us, you're actually making things worse for us, specifically for people of African descent. It's in the data. Is anybody looking at it? Is anybody paying attention? So this is what they actually say their methodology is. This is what they claim as one of the things they would cite as what they're doing. They call this a model of cultural oppression and liberation they use in their therapy. So what to say? In this approach, the expression and management of rage is reframed as purging the emotions that are largely the result of assenting to or succumbing to the dysfunctional, damaging beliefs that the oppressor wishes to instill in the oppressed. The expression and management of that rage is encouraged without actually acting on it. So it's right there in the text. They're basically telling you, all that anger and rage you feel of oppression, we're going to teach you how to not act on it. So what does Rocha actually do? I can't even get into this in the talk. It's already long. They claim to be using a Native American organic healing methodology. And the book they cite is a white guy who was a prosecutor who went to the Native Americans of Canada. So this is what they're using. It's not an African-centered methodology. And the book they cite is the white guy who basically is Columbusing the indigenous healing practices from the Native peoples. Who do they do it with? They do it with the community and the cops. So your evidence-based alternative to policing is just literally using CBT to make people not anxious about being cool with the cops. And they claim this in their literature. They claim it proudly in their funding literature. They send this to funders. During a break later on, one of the gang duty detectives approached a young man. Was I there when it happened? Was I one of the arresting officers? Yes, you were. So when I showed up, was I okay? Yeah, you were fine. To be honest, if someone did that to my mother, I don't know that I wouldn't have done the same exact thing you did. So we just talked about police gangs. And the structural racism in policing is undeniable at this point. But by suturing individual affective encounters between gang members and the police, they're giving the police opportunity to absolve themselves the structural violence that's at the core of their organization. Again, there are literal street gangs in the LAPD. Barroca wants to have a literal powwow with the cops so that you aren't anxious about them anymore, that you aren't doing things like politicking for social change and police reform. They literally say their methodology is to make you cool with not doing that so you don't feel anxious anymore. How do we deal with the data? They keep beating us over the head with these data-driven metrics. 85% of young men come to Roca with a violent record, 4 out of 5 ending crime. How do you, you can't argue with statistics, can you? Yes, you can. So if you actually listen to when Roca talks, they say that recidivism is assumed in their methodology. So the people they bring in do get rearrested. They just don't get charged and convicted. And why is that? Has nothing to do with the treatment they give those people. We know for a fact, with the study I presented to you earlier, we as a community could produce equally good results if we had the money. But they have connections with the DA. They have connections with the state's attorney. So when a Roca person comes up for sentencing, everybody knows if we can get this person off, let's just give him back to Roca. Because what Roca is doing is essentially allowing us to present a positive veneer on what is essentially still the police and surveillance state, but having the police surveillance state look like a kinder, gentler social service state, that's better for everybody. So having Roca do it means that we don't have to worry about the Nation of Islam doing it. Having Roca do it and them essentially suturing community relations between the police and the cops, and they do circles with the cops for healing and whatnot, having them do it means we don't have to pay people from the community who could actually produce more structural political change if we paid them to do it. So it's good for everybody. Look at the people who fund Roca, Arnold Menchus, the people who did the spy plane, Whiting Turner, construction companies. I'm going to skip a couple of slides coming up, but the idea is that the people funding Roca are totally fine with gentrification. But they know that old school war on drugs beat black folk on the head policing. Young knowledge economy educated white folks, they don't want that in their communities because they think it might produce a riot. And it makes them feel bad. It's good white liberals. So they need a form of policing that they can live with, that actually allows them to feel good about what's happening in their community. And Roca essentially allows them to feel good because it's framed as social services. I'm just going to skip a lot of this. I've given this analysis in other talks. I will actually talk about this. So this is actually Camden, New Jersey, the so-called city that abolished the police. And they basically brought in a lot of Obama nonprofit policing experts to redo the police department. But in the process of defunding the police, they actually paid cops less and hired more of them. So by defunding the police, they actually brought more police into the community. But the point is in this article, and I'll just go back to the citation real quick, what disbanding the police really meant in Camden, New Jersey, it was part of a gentrification campaign. Camden Rising is Camden's redevelopment plan, created by powerful non-Camden residents aimed at attracting young white professionals to move here. The shift in governing power over public services, including education, housing, economics, and public safety from Camden's predominantly black and Latino residents to county and state officials. In 2013, the creation of the CPD was an integral to the Camden Rising redevelopment strategy of recasting Camden, long viewed in local and popular media as dangerous, as now safe. The argument is that what the rebranding of the CCPD meant in Camden, essentially what Roca is for Baltimore. It allows them to rebrand essentially a program for the police as an alternative to policing, but it's something that they can sell to businesses and young knowledge economy folks as we're not doing the old school the wire style policing. We're doing something kinder and gentler that we can sell you is going to prevent murder because Roca has the stamp of Harvard as an academic institution, right? So I'm just going ahead and skip to the grand finale, which is, let's look at this map again. If you actually understand this map through everything we've talked about, it actually kind of feels like the people in blue are like surveilling the community. It actually feels like they're almost hoarding and getting the people in the community into these institutions. it almost feels like, and again, this is not what Brothers on the Ground want to do or are doing, but what they want them to do, what the model is asking them to do, is essentially just be cops. But to, instead of sending them to jail, we're going to hoard them into the clinics that do CBD. We're going to hoard them into the public health infrastructure because we all make money giving those people services. We all make money by expanding the public health infrastructure as the alternative to policing. So they talk about wraparound services. Again, this is the classic symbol for hate, a house, the snake symbol. Think of it as them constricting you. Like when you hear the term wraparound services, if they're not explicit about the community controlling those services, I think of them literally as constricting and controlling the community, all in the name of violence prevention. They love that term, wraparound services. I'm asking you to reframe that term in your mind. But here's the kicker. Don't take my word for it. This is Rocha, in their own words, on a talk with Harvard on reimagining public safety about how they actually implement this methodology. So I'm just going to play 1 minute of this talk and just hear what they say.
The rank and file make sure that the other officers go. So when we do circle training and it's for the community policing, well, as soon as you come out of the academy, your first run is community policing. And then, so they make them come. So a lot of times they're like, I don't know, my sergeant told me to be here, you know, and I'm getting overtime or whatever. And that's okay. But by the end of it, they're seeing our young people who are working in the streets on, you know, with their ROPA sweaters on. They're like, hey man, how you doing? You're doing a great job. Right. Because oftentimes they ask, what can we do? And we're like, well, when you see him, say, do a good job. Or when you see him not doing a good job, you know, hem him up, but call me and say, hey, if you're not at ROCA on Monday, I'm gonna take this dime bag and process it.
If you're not at ROCA, hem them up, say, I'm gonna take this dime bag and process it. If you're not at ROCA, I, as ROCA, am giving you the cops permission to put my kids in the criminal justice system. This is not doctored footage. This is not a deep fake. This is what ROCA actually says is their methodology. They aren't defund the police. They are the police. Literally. They're telling you right to your face. But they want us to accept this public health methodology as some alternative to policing. It's infuriating, quite frankly. And again, the most powerful institutions, Whiting Turner, Bank of America, Able Foundation, all behind this institution that clearly states in their methodology, we have no problem selling you out to the cops because your job is to serve us, not the other way around. I actually wanted to end on something that brings the point home and expands the conversation internationally, because as they said, Cure Violence said, this is an international model. This goes beyond America, and if we call ourselves African-centered researchers, let's have the Pan-African analysis. So that's a protest movement in Colombia. Colombia, South American nation, longtime supporter by the American regime for right-wing politics in Colombia to crush the left there, especially in the Afro-Colombian Spanish-speaking portions of the country. Colombia is one of the very few nations with a large Spanish-speaking population of African descent. Of course, you see Portuguese in Brazil. But they had in the Afro-Colombian majority city of Cali, Colombia, a massacre for pro-democracy, anti-austerity, anti-right-wing protest, anti-fascist protest. This is essentially what the Black guerrilla family was trying to get us to support in happening in Colombia, and the right-wing American-supported police force killed 50 people, largely Afro-Colombian. So let's actually look at who trains the police in Colombia. 2005, Dr. Oscar Rojas, Alvear Alice Foundation. So what is he saying about him training the police in Colombia? Does Alvear Alice ever partner with the police? Rojas, there is a need to involve the police department in every effort to address youth on youth violence. Within the USAID program, we have allocated some of the budget to carry out training for the police force and also for members of the judiciary system. I am not quite sure what the image of USAID in Colombia is, but I am sure that collaborating with restorative justice organizations is the best way for USAID to contribute to the peaceful resolution of conflict in Colombia. Translation. I am giving money to train police in Colombia, but I'm getting the money under the guise of bringing reconciliation and justice to Colombia. USAID is a front for American interest in foreign policy, but they claim to be giving aid. And what I know is the best way for them to launder their image in Colombia is to look like they're doing restorative justice work. So So that's who the Alvaro Alice Foundation has been as of 2005. But when they wanted to institute the cure violence model in Colombia, who did they go to? The Alvaro Alice Foundation. And it's so insane, you can't even find this analysis in English. I had to read it in Spanish. So the same people who they are telling you are the people you should fund as part of your defund the police movement are the people training police on how to murder Black and brown people in Colombia. This is what happens to us when we do not have the autonomy to be able to say no to foundation money. This is what happened to us when we do not have an independent research institution that is committed to rigor and excellence in research and not just repeating what someone said on NPR. And this is why I wanted to give this talk, to explain all these things that I'm seeing around violence as a method, violence prevention as a methodology to launder the police surveillance state through the veneer of defund the police. And to explain to folks that we at LBF are not going to stand for it. So if you're one of these folks who say defund the police, we know what to fund, fund social services. No, we refuse. Anyone who watches this talk should refuse as well, because that is not actual liberation. That is laundering the nonprofit industrial complex through the veneer of social justice. So what are the conclusions? Engage Black elders and Black civil society from a spirit of learning and humility, not believing you have all the answers and they need to be converted. This goes back to the Black folks at the community meetings where they may go to the community policing meetings. These may be Black folks that own homes in West Baltimore. And they may be like, I don't know about this defund the police thing. We're being told to think of those folks as Black conservatives who are brainwashed by the military state. And it's like, no, like I've seen what happens when they talk about funding the community. We get orchestra kids. But I can curse out the community policing person. And if they're not good to me, they will be fired. Now, that does not deal with the fundamental violence of the system. But because the police chief is accountable to the mayor and I can vote out the mayor, I have some juice there because I can mobilize votes against the mayor. I can't mobilize votes against the ABLE Foundation hit. I can't mobilize votes against personal orchestra kids. I can't mobilize votes against the Avera Lise Foundation doing training in Colombia. And that's where the importance of democratic power becomes valuable. And I think this is what some of our elders know that many of the younger folks are just not understanding. Second, Pan-Africanism as a methodology, not only as an ideology. I care about Colombia personally, but the value of adding it to the talk was to understand that what's happening in Colombia is part and parcel of the engine of co-option that's happening here. Much of the nonprofit industrial complex critique comes from developing nations, African nations, evaluating NGOs, Western NGOs in their community. So the very act of giving this talk through this lens is part of that Pan-African methodology, even though I'm not waving an RPG flag behind me. So understanding it as a methodology, not just as an emotional ideology, is important. So in terms of defund the police stuff, tie specific cuts to police precincts and specific organizations in the area you would shift the money to. So don't just say social services. Say, we have 300 patrol cops in the Western District. They make $70,000 a year. Get rid of 50 of those people on the ground. Take that $50,000 in salary and put it into Baltimore Brothers, because that forces the people in the community to make a choice. 50 patrol cops or Baltimore Brothers, not general defund the police and general social services. Because if you have the second one, they're going to be like, I don't know. But if you have the first one, it's like, okay, I know Captain Andrew. Oh, I know Baba Alamola. Oh, I know the people at B360. Oh, I know people who actually do work. And if I could get them to work with these brothers on the streets as opposed to the cops, I would support that. So you're actually being specific about taking on the reality of how power works and saying, look, this is the reality. We have to fund the people who actually are doing the work, the real evidence-based methodologies, not the people who control the evidence and who gets to accumulate the evidence, who gets to see the evidence, not them telling you what the evidence-based methodology is. Look beyond the police budget. Vigorously defend local control of resources and ensure funded programs reflect the community, what the community deems best practice to prevent the repeat of R3, i.e. real reparations for the war on drugs and our cannabis, through cannabis legalization. We're going to legalize cannabis in Maryland pretty soon. They want to basically replicate R3 here in Maryland. And I've been telling them, no, I'm not going to support it. I'm going to call bullshit on it. And they're like, why? And I'm like, because it's bullshit. And I'm giving the talk to explain the largest theoretical implications behind that analysis. Because I've seen who they bring on. Because when they call bullshit in Illinois, they say, no, Jalen Ross is a good dude. He works on the street with brothers who commit violence. You calling him racist? And that's how they get you. right? They strategically place certain people to launder the white power, i.e. Arnie Duncan's crew, behind the process through the face of someone like Jalen Alston. And that's what, and that's what's, that's not any individual person being evil. That's the inertia of white power and white supremacy controlling our institutions. So if we're not very explicit about resisting that, we're just going to get people doing their same BS, calling it violence prevention, and trying to get access to reparations money. And that's why we have to be specific about when they legalize cannabis, send that money to the local level, as opposed to keeping it in Annapolis. Because they get in Illinois, they kept it in Springfield, the state capital. And the people in Chicago are too busy fighting over the crumbs in places like Evanston, no offense, to focus on the bigger piece of the pie that people like Arnie Duncan's crew and Jalen also are giving up to their buddies. And this is how they get us with the bait and switch approaches, because everyone knows about what's happening in Evanston, this beautiful reparations program. That's $500,000. They have $100 million sitting in a bank in Springfield with Jalen Alster and his friends divvying that up, and we're not even paying attention to it. That's not disrespect to the people who worked hard on what the reparations program in Evanston. That's an understanding of the reality of scale and power and saying we have to fight hard to control our resources at every level. Champion research into alternative methodologies, building evidence and theory base to shift academic hegemony away from Eurocentric theories, practices, and institutions. When I did the research on African-centered youth interventions, they did a meta-analysis, and they found only 10 articles that were peer-reviewed have actually quantitatively evaluated African-centered interventions. Now, there are a lot of college theses on African-centered work. There are a lot of individual people who talk about the value of it, but the actual meta-analysis yielded only 10 quantitative empirical analysis of the impact of African-centered youth development programs. That's not an accident. That is the power of the people behind Cure Violence, behind ROCA, being very intentional in saying, this is who we believe should be the hegemon of expertise in this industry, and we're just not gonna fund your program. Like, if you want a National Science Foundation grant, you're not going to get it for the program in Chicago. You're going to get it for doing the app for the street outreach workers, because that fits within their political economy. But that's why we have to be overt about resisting that inertia and demanding those resources go to actually evaluate our programs. I'm not afraid of numbers. I don't love them. As a researcher, I'm not afraid of quantification. I'm not afraid of evaluation. I just need to know that we actually are evaluating what the community wants evaluated, not what the nonprofit industrial complex wants to center in our evaluation process. Finally, and thank you for sticking with me. This was longer than I expected, but I had to get through all of it because this talk drove me, researching this stuff drove me crazy, and I'm hoping it's driving you as crazy as well. And it's the last point, is that you need to attack the ideological infrastructure of the nonprofit industrial complex just as rigorously as you, it should be you, attack police budgets. ROCA produce, they are one in the same. I mean, again, just listen to what she said on her talk. Hem them up, process the dime bag. And that's fine. That's fine. Because Whiting Turner was fine with that. Because that's another tactic they use to lock you into their social service network. And as long as they can continue to do TED Talks and spin what they're doing as an extension of defund the police movement, the white gentrifiers and the POC gentrifiers that moved to Baltimore would just support it. Because in their mind, it's all better than being in jail. It's all better than people dying in the streets, which in their mind is the only alternative. So we shouldn't just resist ROCA, we should defund ROCA, and we should defund white supremacy. Now, individual foundations, they can do whatever they want. I don't have no democratic control over them. But our tax dollars, the millions of tax dollars that go to things like ROCA, I view that as the exact same thing as the police budget, and I'll say it. And some folks can't say it because they're taking money from the same people who give money to ROCA. And that's just a reality. That's just the reality of when you build your institutional infrastructure in a way that doesn't allow you to actually follow where the research is actually telling you to go. And that's why we do things like fee-for-service contracts, that's why we do research contracts, even when the contract is going to end with us telling the institution hiring of stuff they don't want to hear. Because, hey, I'm already paid. And I don't have to advocate for what you wanted me to advocate for because you already paid me to do the research and consulting. And having independent researchers with an independent methodology, trained in African-centered methodology, not just ideology, not just the veneer of African-centered ideology, is how we can actually produce movements that are independent and actually resist the inertia that allows us to view things like ROTA as defunding the police, to view things like cure violence as the best practice, to view people like our community as fundamentally diseased, and obscures the disease of Columbus, the disease of the white police gangs, and actually want to make you more amenable to that form of violence. And I know this is a lot, and it might be frustrating to hear in terms of, oh man, this is the stuff I thought was going to make it better, it might be making it worse. That's how white supremacy works. And to a certain extent, I feel a sense of hope that it's just so clear that this is a hustle, you know, that once you actually get a chance to expose it, you don't have to be beaten down by the numbers they throw at you. You can have a framework to interpret them and just say, hey, you have those numbers, I don't trust them. Show me your data. And if you don't understand it, send it to me. Or send it to folks in your community and say, what are they doing here? I don't trust it. That's fine. It doesn't make you anti-science. It doesn't make you anti-expertise. That makes you demand that you control how you determine expertise. This is our community and our tax dollars. And we need to continue to demand expertise that takes our suffering and our pain as seriously as we take it. And hopefully we can build institutions like LBS, you know, God willing, that continue to serve that function for us.
We appreciate you sticking with us through that talk. I hope some of the revelations toward the end around Columbia and hearing what the people from ROTA actually do in their own words justified the length of that episode, again, kind of completing the cycle we started with the analysis of public health infrastructure, nonprofit infrastructure overseas, and the issues with that, kind of completing the cycle by seeing that kind of come home in its violence prevention work. So, of course, the initial primary purpose of that talk was to explain to folks the fee-for-service research work that I do in collaboration with other folks here at LBS. So we're going to have more information on that on our website over time at lbsbaltimore.com. So you can check in there if you want information about that. Also, the talk hit upon two of the advocacy campaigns that we'll be working on, some local defund the police work, and of course, come the legislative session statewide in Maryland in January, the cannabis legalization work that we've been working on for a while is going to pick up hot and heavy come 2022 as the state of Maryland moves towards legalization. So find us on Facebook at LBS Baltimore, go to our website, especially sign up for our email listserv, because that's where a lot of the information will be about our summer seminars. Our new Timbuktu seminars are also coming up. You can sign up for that all at our website, lbsbaltimore.com. In terms of the future of this feed, folks who have been listening for a while will know that we've had to change things up. We initially had a lot of support and a lot of infrastructure for a more heavily produced sort of Black, This American Life type of thing. And I appreciated doing that work. I really love doing podcasts. We may be looking at changing things up a little bit. We have an opportunity to potentially do more work on YouTube. So this talk was a slideshow, a presentation given on YouTube, but we're looking at maybe doing something more like a YouTube show and bringing in another co-host who could maybe help anchor some of the work on YouTube. This feed would still be a place to get access to the knowledge and material we would be sharing on that YouTube show, and definitely still committed to the audio format, but we're just trying to get the information out there in any way that people get access to it and people can really engage it. So stay tuned, watch this space, as they say, and we look forward to continue to go on this journey in search of Black power in whatever form or format we possibly can in the future. So thank you, and hopefully talk to you soon. Take care.